European Patent Office podcasts bring you an insight into the technology and innovation shaping the world.
Getting the scope of your intellectual property right at an early stage and aligning it with your business is crucial. But how do you go about it? In this podcast, our guest Antonio will guide you through some of the critical points that you should check before investing in any form of IP. We will discuss why analysing what others have worked out before you will help you learn about what you can protect and where to find this valuable information, and importantly, how you can use it to find alternatives and avoid unpleasant surprises later in the process. I'm talking today with Tony Lopez Carrasco, physicist and lawyer. He's presently an in-house senior patent expert with Telefonica. Tony's got an extensive background in intellectual property. He's managed a patent attorney's firm and been a consultant for all kinds of small and large companies. He frequently lectures on IP strategy and management in international business schools and in universities. And he's previously worked as a patent examiner. So who better to talk to about IP rights? Welcome, Tony.
Thanks a lot, Alison. Thanks for having me.
I'm very much looking forward to our conversation here. And I think our listeners will be particularly interested to understand what they need to think about upfront if they're planning to invest in intellectual property, or IP, as we often call it, and also how they might avoid any nasty surprises. Getting a scope of your IP right and ensuring that it aligns with your business needs is something that I know that you feel is crucial. And I have to say, I agree with you on that. So what I'd like to explore with you in this podcast is how the listener can go about understanding the kind of scope that they're going to have with their IP and the critical checklists that they're going to be using. Now, we will be hearing in other podcasts about different aspects of IP, including the nitty-gritty of the different kinds of intellectual property. So today, really looking at that, you know, step one to a certain extent, what we need to think about right up front. And for me, one of the things that I always like to think about to kick off when I'm looking at IP is, has anybody else got there first? It's an area where there's quite a lot of jargon. And so I'm really looking forward to you talking us through some of these areas and demystifying that jargon for our listeners. So the first one is prior art. What is prior art, Tony? And what effect does that have on a piece of IP that you might want to file?
Right. So there is a rule of thumb that anything that you publish and it's available to any free member of the public is prior art. So imagine you have a publication in Japanese only published in Japan. Is that prior art for the rest of the world? It is prior art. Do you want to patent this? You can't, just because there is prior art and it has been published maybe in a language that wasn't yours, but nevertheless, this is the standard. So it's quite simple. Also, if you disclose, so if you tell someone, if you tell your neighbor about that wonderful secret you're keeping and you want to patent it, and there is no confidentiality obligations, then, unfortunately, that is also a publication and means that it's part of the prior art and later on you can't patent it. So the takeaway here would be, if you want to protect your IP, first of all, you should have a certain secrecy policy.
Oh my goodness me. So what this means is that we have to be alert to both what other people might have disclosed or protected, but we've also got to be very careful about what we disclose ourselves as well. And so your suggestion is, and I think quite rightly, that we think very carefully about what we say and to who we say it as well. Of course, one of the things there that I think sometimes we have to be careful about is being so nervous about disclosing any information that actually we don't tell anybody anything. And I've certainly seen a few situations happen where when it comes to disclosure, everybody wants to put in place a non-disclosure agreement or a confidentiality agreement. And that can sometimes hold things up enormously. And I don't know if you've had this experience, but I certainly have. When you have a conversation, perhaps with a company or a potential investor, first off, they're not interested in signing any kind of disclosure, because one of the things that I've often heard them say is, at the beginning, don't tell us anything that you think is secret. Give us a general idea about what this is about, but don't give us the secret details. And if we're really interested in talking to you at that stage, then we'll sign a legal agreement. Have you had that experience yourself?
It's by default the experience. If you're offering your great invention or your thoughts and then your protected IP, or even before you protect it, to a bigger company, of course, they will tell us, give us what it does and how efficient it can be, and do not reveal any confidential information, because we first need to know whether we could be interested. And bigger companies, when they invest, they wouldn't want to run into any liability problems, meaning that, oh, there was an NDA was signed, and therefore there was what they call the IP contamination, meaning that you don't know whether later on in life this big company is going to take that project and do developments on their own. It might look like they've taken your idea and they've stolen your idea. It could also be that they're trying to buy your company on the onset, and they don't do so, and later on they have a similar development. So it's very, very important that no confidential obligations start very early, just because they contaminate things. Yes, Alison.
And actually, I don't know about you, Tony, but I've certainly found that it's very possible to be able to explain quite a lot about an idea or an invention without giving away some of that sort of secret sauce at the outset, and everybody seems to be happy. We talked a little bit about the prior art there. Another term that often comes up, and it kind of relates to that, is freedom to operate. Again, can you give us in simple terms, what does freedom to operate mean, and how does that impact on your thinking when you're looking, say, to file a patent application?
Exactly. That will depend on the sectors. Let's take a sector that's very stable and very fashionable nowadays, like the pharmaceutical sector, where any development, any product can be protected by a very limited number of patents and IP. So there would be a patent for the compound, a patent on the way to manufacture that compound. And that is very much able to be tracked by anyone. And anyone can see, okay, I need to respect this and this and this and that. In contrast to that, other sectors like the telecommunication sectors, lots of patents, thousands of patents, must be licensed in one go. And this fragmentation of titles make freedom to operate very, very difficult. Freedom to operate meaning, do I take my products and services out in the market? Am I infringing other people's rights? How many licenses do I need to operate in the market? Operation means commercial operation. And sometimes the answer is no. It is very, very difficult to know this. So freedom to operate has a limited value to some of the sectors.
That's quite interesting. And I certainly, you know, my experience has been, my own background has been, you know, traditionally within the life sciences, where just as you were saying, you're very much interested in protecting a compound or a product. And actually, sometimes what you'll do is you'll build a sort of family of patent applications around it. And what you're really doing is making that clear water, that space where you know that you can operate, and you can actually say, okay, if anybody comes near to me, I can push them away. I can repel these invaders, because I've got a really nice area here. What was interesting to me as I moved into my current role was I did actually get to interact with quite a few companies who were in the telecom space and in the ICT space more generally. And they were saying, no, Alison, that really is of less interest to us, because actually we just want to make sure that we can get our products and services out and that nobody is going to come after us and sue us. So the kinds of relationships we want and the kind of deals that we want to make related to IP, if we want to make them at all, they need to be quick and they need to be simple. And I think for me, what you're saying there is very much around anybody and any of our listeners who are thinking about intellectual property really just needs to think about, you know, the field, the sector that they're working in and what might be relevant to them. But I guess what one of the things that we don't want to do is leave our listeners thinking this is just a really complicated minefield and it's not somewhere to go. Because actually, I think if you do it right, if you're aware of things like prior art and freedom to operate, actually it can be incredibly helpful in terms of honing down what you've got and where you need to go, both in terms of IP and product development. And in order to do that, searching is something that we often hear about, you know, searching to see if there's prior art or you've got that freedom to operate. Sounds great. How do you go about it? And how would our listeners start first off, do you think, Tony?
Yes, the first thing would be to identify the premium features of your technological offer. So if you're going into the market with a few ideas and your cutting-edge technology adds a number of premium features that are different from those of your competitors, then that's very, very interesting. And exactly those premium features are the value of your IP. So you're going and searching those great ideas that you've had. So on day number one, you had those very creative ideas. On the name number two, you try to destroy them by searching anything, anywhere. First, you'd look into the catalogs because you are up there. You're an expert in your sector. You will find nothing, but it's very important that you go into these patent databases. There are these 5 years ahead of your competitors.
Oh, so now tell us, where might you find these patent databases? And they're available and they're free in large part, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you have fantastic tools. You have SPASnet, you have even the patent register, and they're completely free from patent granting authorities. You have EPOSCOPE and you have many others. And for those, of course, that are running professional services, then there will be others that will go under a subscription or a license. But as the first glimpse into that area, you don't even need to pay a single cent. And you can input those patents and those searches into your creative thinking and discarding some of the ideas that are already taken.
Looking at the databases, for example, patents or trademarks, etc., Tony, they can give us a lot of information about what's been filed in the area that helps us think about, you know, potentially the scope of our, say, patent claims. But they're full of other useful business information as well, aren't they?
Absolutely. There's a lot of what we call metadata, or data that goes around your searches. The first one, the first field would be the owner. And this owner could be a niche company having developed fantastic technology. And you don't have to be frustrated. You don't have to say, oh yeah, it's been invented. Your development can sit on top of that IP. And then all together, there is a collaboration opportunity. So you're not only finding competitors, you're also finding allies and other companies you can work with. So maybe it's worth giving not only a try into let's do something different, but let's collaborate with these people. On top of that, you have the names of the inventor saying some inventors go and rotate and move from company A, B, and C. Well, it would be a possibility that at one point they come to your company as well, or you can establish a consultancy agreement with them. So that is very important. So finding names, finding companies, and the jurisdictions they are interested in. You know that the home market normally for a US company would be the US, but there are many niches. And you know where companies produce something, where companies distribute something, and where the clients of that company are, just by the footprint, the number of countries they've been trying to protect. Knowing that is almost tracing the commercial and technical activities of the company, Alison.
That's absolutely fascinating. So we've got their competitor intelligence, We've got market intelligence. We've got potential partner intelligence. And one that I'd not thought of before, which I think is super, is intelligence about talent that might be out there and people that you might actually want to engage with or maybe even employ. What a great idea and what a great resource. But you mentioned there now using professionals, and they're particularly patent and trademark and IP attorneys. And we'll be talking a little bit more about those in one of our other podcasts. But I think just in terms of our conversation today, maybe you could just give us a very quick summary as to why you think it's valuable to talk to an IP professional.
Well, first, do your homework, meaning that have a clear idea of what searches, what tool searches you have that. But once you've done that, if you go and ask a patent professional, a patent attorney, they will let you know that, of course, the prior art searching for whatever came before you is very, very important in the beginning. And in the protection itself, that prior art must be considered and given in the protection, meaning that it has to be disclosed, it has to be told, this is our starting point and our leap forward, our delta, our differentiating, our premium feature is going to be something different. It is of fundamental importance that you yourself have a very good knowledge of what is really the state of the art. What they call the state of the art is what is really available to the public in general.
And that's great, Tony, because that really, sorry to cut across you, but I really like where you're going with that, because that's really saying, think hard about what it is that you really have that's unique. And think about that in the context of what other people may have out there and really refine it. And that's as much about business thinking to a certain extent as about, filing for patent protection. And it's almost like a kind of circular process, isn't it? You have an idea as to what your new idea, concept, invention, or product might be, or your technology. You're thinking through that. You're out there trying to see what else is available. You refine your ideas a little bit more. I mean, it's actually a very sort of positive feedback loop. And then you get to that stage where you go, aha, this is the essence of what I have. And this is the essence of what I need to protect. And I guess if you do that, you're actually, not only does that make really good business sense, but actually it also makes really good financial sense, because then you're going ahead and you're investing money and time in protecting exactly what it is that you need to protect. Or, as you're also saying there, you're protecting what you can protect, and it may be that you can't protect absolutely everything. And I guess in some situations, that's okay. If you've got a particular feature that you're able to protect, that may be sufficient. But you must have lots of examples of from your experience of when companies have thought about IP protection or not thought about it properly. Is there anything that comes to your mind that you'd like to share with the listeners? Maybe an example of some recent acquisitions that you were involved in, also some historic acquisitions you were involved in.
In a recent acquisition, it was revealed that the technical people would have this prejudice, saying that software is not patentable. And of course, nowadays you have computed implemented inventions, meaning that a lot of the methodology of the abstract ways that the software code is implemented is patentable. So at the end of a due diligence process, meaning the reviewing all the assets they have, a lot of IP surfaced. And we were insisting that most of them would be protected, at least from a patenting perspective, alongside with the trade secret, with software code copyright, and the rest. So that was a sort of finding the diamond, which the company itself had not been able to find. That is one example. And the second one, on the very, very positive one, is another company with this 5-minute storytelling that you're allowed to have when you're talking to a CEO, the so-called elevator pitch. You have 5 minutes to tell and convince the other company. You have the mission and vision, and you talk about the technology. And they were, thanks to the patents, they were very much synthesizing, and in a concise manner, they explained and they convinced business people that they had this fantastic IP. And the IP was the basis of the technology and of the business itself. So it's a very, very useful tool to talk about, you know, 3 minutes, and this is what I do. This is what the Prior Art does, state of the art. I'm very, very differential in that sense. And business people, they love it. Because the next question would be, do you have a patent? Have you protected it? Yes, all I've been telling about is the IP, because I know the IP by heart.
That's great, Tony. And you've really resonated on something there for me that it comes out of another in the podcast series, our first podcast, where we're actually hearing that the value from a tech company of having patents just for that very reason you said, and they're actually described there as, you know, your patents can be your ambassador. And I really like how you work that into the elevator pitch. Something else that we might just touch on. We've mentioned the words a couple of times, which are infringement. What does that actually mean? And can you avoid it?
Yes. Yes. So you will learn how to read and write even sometimes parts of a patent. And therefore, in infringement, you will have to look at one of the parts, which is called the claims, which is a one-sentence definition, very simple. So instead of looking up a word into a dictionary, you're looking into the patent, to the section that's called claims. And there you go into claim number one, and it describes a method or a method with steps or a device with features. And reading that definition, if you are bringing products and services to the market that fall within the definition, you are infringing. If you are outside the definition, probably you are not infringing. It is as simple as that. No, once the thing becomes very complex, there is the interpretation, and there's many legal procedures that will sort of take time and money to know that. But beforehand, you can already know about infringement. And yes, if you are developing your technology products and you're reading a patent from a third party, from someone else, and that patent is in force, meaning annuities, fees, and everything has been paid, then you should avoid it. You should circumvent it. You should look at the features of that claim and say, well, in the second step, they do, you know, they go right. Why don't we go left? Why don't we do something different? Maybe you have to renounce to certain functionalities, or you have to do something different. But this is the way you avoid other people's IP. And believe it or not, this is also value for them, because you're respecting the IP from third parties and you're creating your own IP, or you're moving away. You want your features that you bring into the market to be differential and to be far away from those IP.
Have you had any examples of that yourself, Tony, where you've come across organizations needing to effectively invent around finding something different?
Yes, there was a very interesting example. This was the times when telephones were unblocked by this swipe option with your thumb. So you'd hold it at the palm of your hand, and with your thumb, you'd swipe through the screen and then unblock it. There was a litigation campaign by two or three incumbents, so very important companies fighting one another. We were thinking about ways how to unblock the phone, and unfortunately, most of them had been patented. We knew that there was the tip of the iceberg of many other patents, because there were those litigations going forward. It was in another jurisdiction, maybe was basically in the US, but you know that the certain aggression would transverse and come to Europe as well. So we had to find a strange and unintuitive, in the beginning, way of unblocking a phone by a user. And it was very late in development, so there was a lot to be changed. But definitely, respecting IP from third parties and moving away from litigations when you're bringing products and services that are in massive numbers. That's what we did. And it was very, from the IP perspective, it was very, very interesting how you develop and how you have those creative people, those developer teams rearranging things on the fly.
I love the word that you've used throughout our conversation, creativity. That's actually cropped up quite a lot. And, you know, reflecting on it, I think that's absolutely it. You know, the art of the invention, this whole area that we're talking about does require some creativity and a bit of kind of flexibility in your approach. And I think to a certain extent, to sum up what we've been talking about, if you can be creative, if you can understand what's out there, and you can understand what you really need to do to give yourself some good protection, then actually you can put yourself in a very good position in terms of intellectual property to be able to shape a little bit of space in which you can operate. And that works really well for you as a potential company founder or entrepreneur, and for your investors if you're looking to those, because then you can give them some security that there's an area that you're working in and that you can go forward with a degree of comfort. And if you're filing IP, then you've got a defensible position that can stop other people encroaching. Tony, our time is nearly done in this conversation. I can't believe it's gone so quickly. It's been great to hear, you know, your reflections on the area and just hear some of the anecdotes that you've brought from real life. Takeaway for me is that it really is important to understand the scope of the rights that anybody will have before starting to protect their IP. It's a little bit like painting and decorating. My husband always says to me, it's very easy to paint, Alison. The difficulty is in the preparation. And I think it's exactly the same when you're looking at IP. Take time before you actually rush into filing a patent or another form of protection. And that will really shore you up for the future and avoid any surprises down the line. And think very carefully what could be of value to you. Anything else you want to add to that, Tony?
The IP creation, the IP identification, selection and protection is creating value for your company. And it's using that value into your business relations that really, really takes a differential approach to other companies where they don't exactly know what to do. So if you take a few time to reflect, the rest will come on its own.
Brilliant. Tony Lopez Carrasco, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Alison. It's been a real pleasure.
Subscribe to the European Patent Office's podcast channel, Talk Innovation at epo.org. Or on your favorite podcast platform. Let's talk innovation.